got into it. Yeah. I want to get the picture at the last one.
Okay, let's get started here. So I presume most of you made the discussion section yesterday. Okay, so as you know, the first lab is out. It's due in 2 weeks. Get started soon. It's a fairly simple assignment. You can do it in groups if you want, but it's simple enough. If you do it individually, it should be okay. Alright? If you have any questions about this lab, I am here, Anthony, the TA is here, so come and ask us. Okay, I presume we have specified most of the important stuff yesterday. Yes, question.
Quick question. Do you grade on style or is it purely results? How do you...
Okay, so this assignment, I'll answer that in two ways. This assignment will not actually count towards the final grade. Okay, so the objective here is to ensure all of you know enough Java to keep up with what is coming down the road. Okay, so that's just this assignment. Now the question is, how do you do programming assignment? Typically when we give out the first real one, we'll specify what we are looking for. So it is going to be correctness of the code, documentation on the code, ability. We'll run it against some test input. It should obviously provide, it should run correctly first of all. I mean, that's the most important. Beyond that, the design decisions you make, you have to specify that, you have to document the code. So there will be some weightage given to all of these other things as well, in addition to making sure the code itself runs. Okay? We'll specify that when we give out the assignment, saying what are the things you need to keep in mind. Okay. Any other questions on this? It will be graded by a human, which is Anthony, not by a program. Okay, so he'll actually look for style. If it was a program, it wouldn't know whether you wrote comments or not, for instance. Okay, any other questions on the assignment? Okay. So what I will do today is give you a quick introduction on computer architecture. Sort of the stuff you covered in 201 but must have forgotten by now. Okay, so we will revisit most of those things. Okay, so this is just recap of last class. Okay, in one slide. So we basically said operating system kernel is the layer that sits between the hardware and the user and the application. Okay? So it basically takes a physical machine interface and it provides a more convenient, easier to use virtual machine interface to the end user. Okay? So it's the interface between the user and the architecture. And operating the history lesson that we sort of went through told us that operating systems have continued to evolve to accommodate changes in hardware and changes in technology. Okay, and so we'll see some of the hardware features that influence operating system features today. Okay, so what is going to be done today is we'll look at basic OS functionality. That's again a recap from last class. Okay, we did that. We'll just go into provide a recap there, and that will directly lead to the discussion of basic computer architecture concepts. Okay, what are the features in hardware that an operating system needs to provide useful services to the user? Okay, so we look at that mapping, and then basically we will see how architectural support can actually simplify some of the things that the operating system does. Okay, so if some of those features weren't present, the task of the operating system kernel would be much more difficult. Okay, so we'll see how these hardware features can simplify certain tasks. Okay, so let's start with the functionality. The three or four that we were talking about last time, okay, were concurrency, I/O, storage management, and distributed system. Okay. Concurrency is basically the ability to do that the operating system provides you to do multiple things simultaneously. Okay, what those things are might vary. It could be I/O, which means you have multiple programs running at the same time that are all accessing files from disk. Okay, that's concurrent I/O. Okay. You can have concurrent processing, which just says that you have multiple applications running, they are all doing computation on the CPU. Okay, that's concurrent processing. Okay, and you have multi-programming and so on. So what each user that is accessing the machine sees is an abstraction of essentially a private machine. Okay, the OS abstraction essentially is one where you feel you own the machine, you can run processes that you start up, and those processes are isolated from things that other users' processes or applications are doing. Okay? The unit of computation is either a process or a thread. We will come back to processes and threads starting next class. Okay, so we don't need to worry about that here. But the higher level point is the operating system allows concurrency, okay, concurrent I/O, concurrent processing, and so on. Okay. The other functionality it provides is management of I/O devices. Okay, so what it basically does is it allows I/O devices, which typically tend to be slow, to do their work in the background so that some other things can run on the CPU while there is background I/O. Okay. This is also referred to as overlap of computation and I/O. Okay. The reason you need to do this overlap is for better use of resources on your machine. Okay. Simple example is, let's say you have a process or an application that sends off a request to a file. Okay. The file resides on disk. Okay. The disk is an I/O device. Okay. By definition, I/O devices are slow. Okay. An access to disk takes on the order of a few milliseconds or tens of milliseconds. Okay, so that's very slow compared to the speed of the CPU. Okay. So if the process blocks while the I/O is actually being processed by disk, the CPU will idle. Okay, there will be nothing running on the CPU. CPU will idle. You're wasting CPU time. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if you're able to overlap I/O and computation, the better strategy is this process is running. It sends off a request to read some data from a file. Okay, that is essentially triggers an I/O request. And then while the disk is actually trying to process this I/O request, this application cannot do anything. It is waiting. It's blocked. Okay, so what the CPU can do is actually while this process A or application A is blocked, run some other process. Okay, this is, so that process will run while process A is waiting for its I/O to complete. Okay, so now you're overlapping computation and I/O. When some process is doing I/O, other processes can compute, and vice versa. Okay, this makes allows you to use all of the resources on your machine in a better way. Okay, that's what functionality the operating system provides. We will come back and look at this in a lot more detail when we do the third component of this course, namely our file and I/O management. Okay. The other thing that the operating system does is memory management. Okay. So this is the task of allocating RAM to processes or application. When you start a process, the OS has to decide how much memory to allocate. Okay, where to put this process in memory. Okay, and then it has to protect the memory allocated to process A from the memory allocated to process B, so that a process cannot go and muck around with RAM that's allocated to some other process. Okay, that's called memory isolation. Okay, it has to do all of these things. And that's a functionality that the memory management subsystem of your kernel would provide you. Okay? Again, all of this is going to be an entire set of lectures that we will cover at the second major component of the course. Okay? There's this abstraction of files that the operating system provides. Okay? It's easier to use logical abstraction that is mapped onto disk blocks. Okay, so the operating system takes care of low-level management of storage space, which is how data gets mapped onto which parts of the disk. Okay. What the user sees is this easier to use or understand abstraction of a file and directories and so on. Okay. That is handled by the file system, okay, another component of this course. And last but not least, distributed systems and networking. So this allows a group of machines to communicate with one another. Okay. More specifically, it allows a group of processes to communicate with one another to achieve some task. The process could be a web browser and a web server, okay, or it could be any other process that communicates. Okay. So these are some functionalities that operating systems provide. Okay. And so and we looked at them last time. So you can think of an operating system from a variety of perspectives. Okay. One is it is basically a resource manager, okay, that is providing an illusion of a dedicated machine. Okay, that has infinite memory and infinite CPU, we have talked about the operating system as a government that is protecting users from one another. It is allocating resources fairly, so it does resource management and so on. Okay, yet another way to think about it, yeah, it's a complex software system. Typical kernels have tens of millions of lines of code. Okay, so one way to think about an operating system design is how do you take this large software system, make it modular, how do you architect it, and so on. Okay. And the last way to look at it is if you look at the evolution of operating system, the history lesson teaches us how the operating system design has evolved over time, what has influenced these changes in operating system kernels, how technology influences operating system design and vice versa. Okay, so that's basically a summary of what we did last time. Any questions on this? No? Okay. So now what we will do is do a quick rundown of architecture concepts. Okay, so what is shown here is essentially a picture of what is inside a typical desktop, laptop, any machine. Okay, this is something you should be at least somewhat familiar with, at least heard this concept. Okay. So typical machine, any machine has several key components. The CPU or the main processing unit. Okay, this is a thing that runs your code. Okay. There are I/O peripherals. Okay, there are several shown here, including disks. There is the mouse, keyboard, printers, and whatnot. Okay, those are all I/O devices. Typically, you have a graphics card and a monitor that acts as your display. Okay. And then there's main memory or RAM. There's a network card. Okay, it could be Ethernet card, it could be a wireless Wi-Fi card or some other kind of network interface. Okay. Those are the key components. They are all connected by what's called a system bus. Okay, the system bus connects them and it allows each of these components to interact with one another. Okay? Is that clear? That you should all be familiar with. But okay. So now keep that picture in mind. Okay, now what we will do is start peeling the layers a little bit. So we'll take some of the typical operating system services and we will see how those services are built, what hardware features are needed to build those services. Okay, this is just a high level overview. We will actually go into details of this in the next several slides. Okay, one OS service is protection. It could be memory protection, it could be protection between processes, and the kinds of hardware features a kernel uses to provide those protection is the user and the kernel mode bit on the processor, the protected instructions or privileged instructions, there are base and limit registers. Okay? If you don't know what these are, just hold off. We will sort of look at them in the next few slides. Okay? Another OS service is interrupts. Okay? And the way this is done is using interrupt vectors. Okay? Now, system calls that use trap instructions and trap vectors. I/O is also done using interrupts. Okay, the scheduling, error recovery, accounting. This uses the timer. Okay, typically, any processor comes with a timer. Okay, you can use the timer to do a variety of things. Okay, there's a synchronization which uses atomic instruction, and then there is memory management, including virtual memory. This uses TLBs and a variety of other hardware features. Okay, now what we'll do is we'll actually look at each of this in a little more detail and try to understand how to provide that service and what these hardware features do. Okay, let's start with protection. Okay, so the basic way you actually enable protection, okay, there are a couple. The basic one is to use what is called user and kernel mode bit. Okay, typically, if you look at any processor, it comes with a set of assembly instructions. Okay. And assembly instructions can be partitioned into two classes, what are called user mode instructions and what are called privilege instructions. Okay. Privilege instructions are special instructions that can only be run by something, by a trusted software entity. User assembly instructions are instructions that any user program can use. Okay. And assembly instructions such as move, load, store, add, any of these, any programs can run. Okay. But there are several others that are actually mentioned here that only privileged software systems can run, which is in this case the operating system kernel. Okay. Now we'll see what these instructions are and why you shouldn't let user programs run it. Okay, so any instruction that does I/O is a privileged instruction. Any instruction that manipulates the state of memory, okay, page tables, TLBs, is a privileged instruction. Any instruction that enables and disables interrupts is privileged. Any instruction that halts the machine is privileged. Okay. Now let's ask the question, why should user program not be allowed to do those things directly? Okay, why should a user program not be allowed to do direct I/O or in execute an I/O instruction? Yes.
You lose the abstraction. You lose the layer of abstraction. The whole point of OS is to make these things simpler, and it also would possibly allow you to trample up programs You could write over their memory space or whatever.
Right, okay. So you lose the abstraction, but since we are talking really of protection, the abstraction will move aside for now. Really the problem is if you let a program directly do whatever it wants on your disk, on your hard disk, think what would happen. Okay, suppose that there's a disk, there are two users that use this machine. Okay, and let's say both users have put their email on that disk. Okay, if you let a user program access that disk directly, okay, then user A could then go and access files that user B stored, namely somebody else's email, which probably is not what that user intended when they kept their sensitive data. Okay, you could override data, you could read data that you're not supposed to use and so on. Okay, so typically to prevent, so this is what protection means, to prevent users or programs from accessing data that they are not supposed to access, you do not let a program do I/O directly. Okay? That doesn't mean that the program cannot do I/O. Clearly you've written Java files where you opened a file and read that file from disk. Okay? You can do I/O, but what happens really is the operating system is doing that I/O on your behalf, on the user's behalf. Okay, so that's what a privileged mode instruction. And the same is true of memory management. Okay, so you are not allowed to change the state of memory. Okay, for the same reason, you don't want some other process that's also loaded in memory to get access to some other process's RAM, and vice versa. Okay, so if you have to change the state of memory, you basically do that as a privilege instruction. So all of these are privilege instructions. And the only way to execute this privilege instruction is to execute them in what is called the kernel mode of the processor. Okay? Typically, these processors have a bit. If the bit is 0, then you are executing in user mode. Okay? And if it's set to 1, you are executing in kernel mode. If you are in user mode and any user process tries to execute this instruction, that user process will be terminated. It gets a hardware fault and it stops. Okay? Because you are not supposed to be doing those things. Only if you are in kernel mode, if the kernel mode bit is set, will the hardware actually allow you to execute those processors. Execute those instructions. Okay? And typically what happens is when the kernel is executing on the CPU, the kernel mode bit is set. So it can do any of those things. Okay? When a user process is executing on the CPU, that bit is not set. Which means if it tries to do any of those things, it will basically cause a trap and may be terminated. Is that clear? Okay, so the first architectural feature is user and kernel mode, which is used to do protection. Yes, question.
Is it like, could it be more than one bit, like in Linux, like read write and stuff like that?
Okay, could it be more than one? So the Linux read write bit is not the same as this bit. Okay, those are bits that are set on accesses to files. This is actually a bit on the CPU. Okay, if that bit is set, then you can execute these instructions. If the bit is not set, the hardware will not allow you to execute. If you issue that instruction, it will basically not execute. It will throw an error. Okay, so we are talking about different bits here. Okay, so this is actually a user and kernel mode bit on the CPU, in the hardware. What you are talking about are access control bits on files, which is not what this is. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, that's the first hardware feature. So now you can see, if your hardware actually supports user and kernel mode, the task of the operating system is much simpler. All it has to do is whenever the kernel runs, it sets the bit and it can do these things. And it doesn't have to worry about if the bit is not set, are the user processes doing things they are not supposed to do. The hardware is doing the policing on behalf of the operating system. Okay, this is how the task of the operating system has been simplified, because the hardware supports a feature that is used to provide protection. Is that clear? Was this covered in 201? No. Okay. Alright. So now we have this user and kernel mode bit. So now let's take the simple program that wants to do I/O. Okay, we said processes cannot do I/O directly. Okay? Only the kernel can do it. So how is a user process going to do I/O in this world where the actual task of doing that I/O is left to the OS kernel, yet the thing that initiates that I/O is a user process? So think of a very simple Java process that opens a file and wants to read that file. That's doing I/O. Okay, how is that going to work if the Java process is not actually allowed to directly do I/O? Okay, is the question clear? Okay. So now the way this is going to work is somehow the user process has to initiate that I/O, and then the operating system has to take over and actually execute that task on behalf of the user process. Okay? This is done using what is called a system call. A system call is a special function call that a user process invokes and tells the OS, do this on my behalf. Okay, it's the API, it's also the API that the operating system kernel provides you. Okay. So whenever a user process wants the operating system to do something for it, it calls the appropriate system call or the function call, and that allows the operating system to know what the user process wants to do, and the OS then goes and does it. Okay, so this is a picture, this is a description of how system call works, this is a picture that shows what's happening. Okay, so let's go back to the I/O example. Let's say process A, Java process A, wants to read a file. Okay, so process is executing, it basically reads, it just basically says read this file. Okay, it does whatever, and then what happens at that point is that the JVM in this case will make a system call. Okay, the system call essentially causes what's called a trap. Okay, it basically does a trap, and the trap causes the user process to be suspended, the execution of the user process to be suspended, and the kernel actually begins execution. Okay, so essentially this user process, you suspend the execution, the kernel begins executing. Okay, and then the kernel essentially looks at what was the trap, and then based on what system call was invoked, it knows what to do. It lets actually execute the code for that system call. In this case, it will do I/O, it will get the output, it will get the data that was being read from file. Okay, and then it will basically return from the system call. Just as any function return, it will return. At this point, the kernel will stop executing and the user process will execute again. Okay? So as you see, whenever the trap occurs, the mode bit is actually set to kernel mode. Okay, you switch from user mode to kernel mode so that the kernel can actually go and do, in this case, I/O for you. Okay, is this clear what I just said? Okay. Yes, your question.
Technicality. I think it's earlier you said that the in kernel mode the bit would be set to 1, but user mode the bit would be set to 0. Here it's the opposite. Is there consistency there? Or
no, it just depends on the hardware.
Okay.
It just means in one case it's kernel, one case it's user. Certain CPUs will say when it's 1 it's kernel mode, others will say when it's 0.
Okay, so there's no convention there?
There's no real convention. Any other question? Okay, so here are some examples of system calls. You probably, if you haven't done systems programming, haven't programmed at this layer. Yeah, typically when you write a process, you program against a library API. Okay, if you're writing a Java application, you use the Java API. Okay, if you're writing a C or C++ application, you will use a you will program against the C library or the C++ library. The libraries in turn actually invoke the system calls. Okay, when you do print in your program, the print will actually do the right thing, which is write. You'll call the write system call and actually write to either your screen or write to a file or whatever it is. Okay, so here are some examples. Okay, so these are the system calls for process management. Okay, so you can create a process, you can wait for a process, you can execute things, can cause a process to terminate and so on. These are system calls for file management. You can open a file, can close a file, read from a file and whatnot. Okay. So you don't need to know about all of these details. We will come back to them as when we talk about process management, file management. This is just giving you an example of what system calls look like. Okay, this is in the Unix world. So here are some Windows system calls. This is the Win32 API. Okay. So you have similar calls to create a process, to open files, to close files, to modify directories and whatnot. Okay. This is the API the OS provides. Okay. Processes can be programmed directly against the API, but then you are programming at a much lower level. You are not programming against a library API, you are programming against a system call API. Okay. Is that clear? Any questions on what system calls are? Yes, no? Okay, so that is protection. Okay, that's just one feature, or rather that was just one part of protection. The other protection features, we look at how memory protection can be achieved. The other kind of protection I was talking about is a process shouldn't get access to the memory or the RAM that belongs to another process. So how could the operating system achieve this? Right? And what hardware feature would you need to enable that protection? Okay, so I'll think about this. So suppose you have two processes that have been loaded in memory at the same time. Okay? You want to prevent process A from accessing any of the RAM that has been allocated to process B and vice versa. How should the OS enable this protection? What would you do? Any thoughts? It's not as difficult as it thinks, as it looks. How would you prevent a process from accessing the RAM contents of another process? Yeah.
You just have on the stack sections that are allocated to each job, and if one job has a particular process ID that's trying to access the memory of another job, you prevent it.
Okay. So if I were to rephrase what you are saying, what you would do is every time you execute an assembly instruction that accesses some memory, you should check whether the address that you are trying to access belongs to this process or some other process. Okay, if it belongs to some other process, you should deny or not execute, saying you are trying to access somebody else's RAM. Okay, so the one way you would enable protection is every time you execute an assembly instruction that accesses some region of memory, you check, is that address belong to this process's RAM or is it somebody else's memory content? If it's somebody else's, you deny. Okay. Now think what might happen if the OS were to actually enforce memory protection this way.
Slow.
Be very slow. Every time you have to execute an assembly instruction, you have to do all these extra checks. Okay, so that will basically slow down your performance. Yes, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Just like allocate a certain amount of memory, and if it tries to, for the application tries to go past that amount of memory, it just doesn't allow it.
Yeah. So rather than doing these checks, you basically what you're saying is you basically allocate a certain region of memory, and if you try to access something that goes beyond that bound, then you don't do it. You don't allow it. Okay. Now you could actually implement the same concept in hardware using what are called base and limit registers. Okay, so here is what the hardware feature that you actually use to enforce memory protection. The OS doesn't do these checks. The hardware has a feature that does that check automatically. Okay, so this picture actually shows the OS, and it shows four processes that have been that are loaded in memory. For simplicity, we assume that each of them has been allocated a contiguous region. That doesn't have to be the case, but we will assume that job one is loaded in this region of RAM, job two, your job three, job four. So what happens is there are two special registers that the hardware provides. They're called base register and a limit register. The base register has the address of the first word of this process. Okay. The limit register basically has the memory address of where the process ends in RAM. Okay, so this could be address 100 and this 100 words in size, and address 100 and there's 199. Okay. Now every time you execute an instruction that accesses memory, the hardware will automatically check that memory address against the base and limit register. Okay, only if the address lies in between are you accessing the region that is of RAM that's allocated to this job. Okay, if you actually are accessing an address that's less than the base or more than the limit, then you are accessing this part of memory or that part of memory, which is automatically denied. Okay, so hardware is doing this check. Once you have the right values in the base and limit register, anytime you execute an assembly instruction, you do this check in hardware. Okay, since you're doing this check in hardware, this check is very fast. Okay, you are not going to see any performance slowdown. If you are to do this check in software, for every assembly instruction, you will have some compare instructions, and you slow that check down. I mean, you slow the performance down tremendously. Okay, so here is another hardware feature that allows you to implement protection much more easily, in this case without any performance load. Okay, so that's the second feature. Any questions on base limit registers? Okay. Okay, so here is another picture to keep in mind as we continue this discussion. This is a picture of what a process, typical process looks like. A typical process that is loaded in memory has multiple what are called memory segments. In this case, we have what's called a text segment, a data or the heap segment, and the stack segment. You probably have at least heard this term. The text segment contains the assembly code, the binary code for the process. Okay, that's the actual set of instructions for that process. Okay, that's in the text segment of memory. Okay, the stack segment are actually the stack. Okay, the stack grows downwards as each function calls another function recursively. Okay, and as the function returns, you pop things from the stack. So it gives a local context of the function that's or the method that's executing. Okay, and the data segment actually has global variables or the heap. Okay, the memory that's allocated dynamically. Okay. In this case, the heap is growing upwards, the stack is growing downwards. In the middle, there's no that region of memory is currently not in use for that process. Okay. So the big the takeaway is that any process has multiple segments. I've only shown three, but there may be 10 or 20 different segments doing doing different things. Okay, so here, let's just assume it's a text, data, and a stack. Okay, so what does this have to do with anything? Okay, so the first thing is what parts of the segments are stored where. Okay, to understand that, we'll assume that any processor or machine has a memory hierarchy. Okay, so basically, memory hierarchy is different storage mediums that have different sizes and different speeds of access. Okay, so at the very bottom, you have the disk. It's the slowest device on your machine as far as storage is concerned. Okay, and then you have RAM. Your RAM is several orders of magnitude faster than the disk. Anything you store in RAM can be accessed much faster than any data stored in disk. Okay, and then you have a sequence of caches. Okay, you may have an L3 cache, an L2 cache, and an L1 cache. Okay, and the sizes of these caches become smaller as you go up the hierarchy, but the caches are also faster to access. Okay, and each of those cache can store either instructions or data that belongs to this process. Okay, so here I showed that you have data and you have instructions. So any part of these text segment, data segment, or the stack segment could be stored in any of those caches. Okay, any of the recently accessed regions of these will be stored in these caches. And then if you have it in the cache, accessing that piece of instruction or data is much faster than going to RAM. Okay. And at the very top, you have the registers. Those are the fastest pieces of memory that are on a machine, but they are fairly limited in number. Okay. So this memory hierarchy you need to keep in mind. Okay. We'll talk about registers and RAMs and so on, but there's something that is common across any machine. So let's talk a little bit about registers. So that each CPU has several types of registers. There are some general purpose registers which can be used to store any variable, okay, any frequently accessed variable, and there are several special purpose registers. Okay, the three that we care about are here as the program counter. Okay, the program counter is a register which basically points to the current instruction, the assembly instruction that's being executed. Okay, there is the frame pointer and the stack pointer which basically point to the region in the stack segment, saying where is the stack currently in RAM. And there are several others like that. Okay, so the most important one is the program counter that we should keep in mind. Okay, so any time a process begins to execute, the task of the OS is to make sure these registers are initialized to the right values, that the program counter is initialized or is pointing to the next instruction, or rather the present instruction that is being executed. The stack pointers are pointing to the right regions in memory and so on. Okay, that the OS is going to do on behalf of the process. Any questions on registers? Okay, so there are several caches that I talked about. Okay, so there are several interesting side tidbits here. I'll just mention one about managing registers and what might happen if you don't actually manage registers in the right way. So now, as you can imagine, the program counter typically. Okay. So if you go back to this picture, okay, so the program counter can only point to some region in the text segment. Okay, typically a program counter should never point to the data segment or some region in the stack segment. Is that clear? Why? So I just said the program counter should point to some region of memory that lies in the text segment. Yes.
You don't want to be dynamically changing the content of your instructions.
Right. Typically, if you once you load the code, you don't want to be dynamically changing the content of your code. Okay. So this is actually the most hardware or processor don't actually have support that says if this is the text segment, then the program counter better only point to that region in text segment. You can actually point that to some region in data and stack segment. This is how viruses are written, incidentally. The typical virus says you basically download some malicious code, and that code is not, the text segment is read-only, you can't change it. But the data and stack segment, you can store any piece of data. So you download malicious code, it will probably get stuck into a heap segment or the stack segment, and then somehow you modify the program counter to point to that region, and then you start executing that malicious code. So that's basically typically how a virus is written. Now if you have a hardware feature, it says if the program counter actually points beyond the text segment, throw an error. Okay? Then you would actually prevent these malicious programs from actually taking over your machine. Okay? Until recently, that hardware feature was not present. Okay? Now the more modern processors actually have a special bit. It's called the NX bit. If you heard of an NX bit, no execute. Okay. So what happens is, when you load this program, you take segments where code shouldn't reside. You take the data segment and you take the stack segment and you set that bit which says that there shouldn't be anything here that should be executed. So that's why the NX bit is set. Now if your virus actually downloads some code here and tries to move the program counter there, because there is an NX bit set for that segment, your hardware will refuse to execute any instructions that are stored there, okay, because it's not supposed to have any instructions. So that actually is a hardware feature that evolved in response to all of the security concerns. Otherwise, you could do all of these bad things. Yes, question.
So how does that work then if you're writing in a language that uses reflection to change its own code as you're going along, like Lisp or something?
Right.
And the compiled as...
Right, so you cannot use, you're right, there are programs, valid programs, which will actually change their code segment on the fly, as you're pointing out. So some of those protection features will not be available. So you will not actually set a read text segment to read only. You allow the text segment to be written to. Okay, but with the understanding that there are issues with respect to protection, because then you can trample over this, override this with potentially bad code as well, in addition to legitimate uses. So it's just... that you will sort of trade flexibility for protection. Another of these trade-offs I was talking about. So you can't have everything. You want flexibility, you give up something there. Okay, but for compiled programs like C, C++, that is a fine feature. Okay, so that's just an aside. You don't need to know about the NX bit. I just thought I'll mention that. Okay. So the next hardware feature that we'll talk about are traps. Okay, so think of a trap as a special condition. Typically, it's an error condition or an exception. If you've done Java, you know what exceptions are. Okay, the trap is essentially an hardware exception. Okay, it's a special condition that has arisen that requires some intervention on behalf of the operating system. Typical examples of a trap are a page fault. It's a attempt to write to a read-only page. It's an overflow, okay, of a variable. It's a system call, and so on and so forth. An I/O instruction, and so on. Okay, so the way traps are processed, so as soon as you do any of those things, there's a special exception instrument, a hardware level exception. What this does is it basically causes the operating system to begin execution. The process that triggered the trap is suspended, the OS kernel starts executing, and then it figures out what is this type of, just as in Java you can have different types of exception, you have different types of traps. So then you say, what is this trap? Okay, what type of trap is it? Okay. And then you basically jump to the appropriate trap handler. This is the exception handler. Okay. And that trap handler will deal with that exception. Okay, I'll show an example in the next slide. So the way this is done, Okay, the way you sort of figure out is there are numbers assigned to traps. Okay, there can be trap 0, trap 1, trap 2, trap 3. It's just a list of different exceptions that can occur. Okay, so your trap 0 is illegal address. Trap 1 is a memory violation. You try to access memory belonging to some other process. Illegal instruction, trap 3 system call, and so on. Okay, so depending on what the process did, you will throw a trap of a certain kind. Okay, then you will go to what is this is referred to as a trap vector. It's essentially a table. Okay? So you index the trap ID and that gives you a memory address. Okay, so this is a memory address. Okay, this memory address says go to this location of memory. Okay, that's kernel memory. And that is where the exception handler for that trap is stored. Okay, so you will basically index this trap vector. You will jump to this memory location and then you will basically execute the code that's stored there. Okay, that's the trap handler for that particular trap. In that case, it's system call. Okay, that's where you'll go to execute that system call. Any question? Okay, is that clear? What a trap is? Okay, so it's essentially, think of it as hardware level exceptions, and the way that that's implemented in the OS kernel is you have a table and one entry for each exception that can occur, and what you have is the address of the trap handler. Okay, and so you index the trap vector, you go to that address, you execute the trap handler. Okay, IO is also done in a similar way, as we will see. Okay, so there are two or three different ways of doing IO. We will look at them. Okay, but the way the high level thing to keep in mind is that given any IO device, okay, typically it has a small microcontroller. Okay, just as a machine has a CPU, every IO device has a small processor, a small microcontroller. Okay, that microcontroller is responsible for managing that device. Okay? So the way things work is that if the CPU wants to access that IO device, typically it will issue a command to that microcontroller. Okay, for a disk, you may say read this disk block, okay, or write to this disk location. You will issue this command to what the disk controller. And the disk controller is the microcontroller for the disk. Okay. And then the IO device, the microcontroller, will go off and start executing that command. Because IO devices are slow, it might take a while. Okay. Once that command has been executed, that microcontroller will raise a trap or an interrupt. Okay. The interrupt tells the operating system that the command that was issued earlier has finished. Okay. So then it can go back to the, if you are trying to read a block from disk, for instance, you can go back to the disk controller and try to read that disk block from the memory of that controller. Yeah, or do whatever you need to do once the interrupt is raised. Okay, there's a picture here, I believe. Okay. So here is, these are two different ways of doing I/O. One is called synchronous, the other one is asynchronous. The way the microcontroller works is the same. Okay. This is the user level process. Everything below this is the kernel. Okay, you don't need to understand all these boxes, but they're there just to give you a flavor of how this works. That's the user level process. Let's say it issues some file IO, a read or a write. Okay, that results in a trap. Okay, or system call. The OS will then issue a command to the disk controller saying read from this location. Okay, that will go to that request goes to the device driver for the disk. The device driver actually issues that to the hardware. Okay. And the hardware then goes and does its own thing. The disk controller will go and does its own thing. After some period of time, the request is finished. Okay. And the hardware will actually raise an interrupt saying, I'm done with this IO instruction. Okay. The interrupt will come back to the device driver. The device driver will read the data from the disk memory into RAM. And then the OS will hand that data back to the process. Okay? Between the issuing of this command and the result coming back from the disk, this process will be blocked. It will not be doing anything. It will be just waiting for this IO to complete. Okay? If a process blocks while it is waiting for the IO to finish, then you have what is called synchronous IO. Okay? In synchronous IO, you issue a request and you wait until the request has finished. And once the request has finished, you resume execution. Okay, this method of doing IO is called synchronous. Is that clear? Here is the picture of what asynchronous IO looks like. Okay, as the name suggests, in asynchronous IO, you do not block after issuing your IO request. Okay, you say read something from a file and the process continues execution. process doesn't block. Process goes and does something else. Okay, that's what is shown here. You send off a request. Okay, it goes all the way to the disk, and you get back a response saying the disk is going to start processing it, and then the process continues execution. It doesn't wait. Now the same thing happens at the hardware layer. IO request is issued to the controller saying go do this IO. The disk controller goes off and starts processing that IO request. At some later point in time, the request finishes. Okay, and then you'd raise an interrupt. The interrupt comes back to the device driver saying that the request has finished. Okay, and the device driver will then interrupt the process because this was asynchronous IO. Okay, so you basically, the process was executing something else. It was not blocked like that scenario. And then you will get back the results. Okay, is that clear? Difference between synchronous and asynchronous. Typically, if you have done any file IO, you are by default, okay, this is the model you assume. Okay, this is used only in special cases, where you want the additional flexibility of not blocking while you are while you have an outstanding IO request. Has anybody done asynchronous IO here? No. Has anybody encountered any asynchronous IO? No.
Only over a network.
Only over. Count as IO. Yeah, you can do asynchronous network IO as well. Asynchronous. Yeah, you have. Yeah, in certain cases like that, it's better to do asynchronous or synchronous. Yeah, but typically, if you have any Java application that's doing IO, you are in this world. Okay, you can do the same thing here. We'll come to that when we do IO. See where asynchronous actually helps. Okay, this has somewhat better performance than synchronous, but it's a lot more complicated to write programs this way. Okay, so that's synchronous and asynchronous. Okay, the another way to think about IO is what is called memory mapped IO. Okay, there's a different way of doing things. Okay, in the previous case, which is also referred to as direct IO, the CPU actually issued a command to the IO device. Okay, saying go read this data, go write to this location and so on, and the microcontroller on that IO device executes that instruction. So you're explicitly issuing requests or commands to the IO device, and the device goes and does its own thing. Okay, that's one way of doing IO. Another way of doing IO is not deal with these low level commands, but do it at using a different abstraction. Okay, the different abstraction is referred to as memory mapped IO, which I think is best illustrated as a picture. Okay, so let's assume there is a disk, okay, and assume there is RAM. Okay, let's not say disk, let's say it's a graphics card. Okay, that's RAM. Okay, typically, if you use the previous mode of operation, any time you wanted to display something on your screen, the CPU would have to write something to the graphics card. Okay, and then the graphics card would output that on your monitor. Okay, so you would issue a command saying write this set of pixels onto this region on your screen, and then your graphics controller will go and do the right things. Okay, that's one way of doing things. Okay, in memory mapped IO, what happens is the region of memory in the graphics card is actually mapped to a special region of RAM. Okay, the graphics card behaves as if it is part of RAM. Okay, so it looks like it's part of your memory. So in this case, you no longer actually explicitly issue commands to the graphics card. You just read or write to this RAM. Okay? And that actually triggers equivalent commands to the graphics card. From a perspective of the OS or the perspective of the user process, you don't have to explicitly issue commands. You just see that device as an extension of RAM, and you just read and write to RAM. Okay? That triggers reading and writing to that device. So if it was a disk, you would actually take the entire disk space and it would appear as if it's a special region of RAM. Every time you write to a memory page, it actually triggers disk IO. Every time you read from a memory page, it triggers disk IO, causes the disk to be read, and it fills that region of memory. Okay? It's a different way of, different abstraction of interacting with an IO device. don't explicitly issue commands. Think of that I/O device as an extension of memory, and just read and write to this special. It's not real RAM; it just looks like RAM. Okay, just so you just pretend as if you are reading and writing memory, and something in the background is actually triggering requests to that I/O device. Okay, this is referred to as memory mapped I/O. Okay, so you are mapping that device into RAM and then doing I/O by reading or writing to memory. Okay, is that clear? This is frequently used to do efficient file I/O. You can take a file on disk and map it into your process address space. Okay, from that point on, it looks like the entire file is now part of your RAM. It just looks like a large character array, okay, large buffer. It just shows, looks like the file is actually present in RAM. You just read and write to that region of memory, and automatically the OS triggers reading and writing to that file in the background. Okay, you don't have to explicitly do it. And there are many other places where this is used as well. Any questions on this? Okay, so asynchronous I/O already finished, so we'll not talk about that. Let's do timers and atomic instruction. Okay, so the timer is a very simple hardware feature. Every processor comes with a real-time clock, where the clock essentially tells you time on that machine. Okay. So the timer essentially is a feature of the clock that says that interrupt me after so many seconds have elapsed. Okay, so the way you do is you set the timer. So you set the timer to 10 seconds and then you start the timer. The timer starts counting down. Okay, when the timer reaches zero, it will raise an interrupt saying those many seconds have elapsed. Okay, that's a feature that the hardware supports. Any processor that has a real-time clock also supports the timer feature. Okay, and it is used for a variety of different things. It can be used to tell the time, obviously, but that the clock is already doing. But it is used for doing accounting and billing. It's also used for doing CPU scheduling. Okay. So accounting and billing essentially says how much CPU time has this process used. Okay. This is used, you use the timer to keep track of how much time the CPU process has run on the CPU. So you also use this for CPU scheduling. Okay, when we talk about scheduling in a few classes, we will see that the way processes actually run is each of them is given a time slot. Okay, that process runs for the time slot, and when the time slot expires, some other process gets to run. Okay, the way it's implemented is using a timer. Okay, you start executing a process and say you have 100 milliseconds. Okay, that's the length of time of your time slot. And you start the timer. Okay, and the process will continue execution on the CPU. When 100 milliseconds have elapsed, the interrupt goes off and then you tell the process saying time is up, time for some other process to run. So you suspend execution of that process, run some other process. And then you cycle between all of these processes. Okay? That's the most common use of a timer on a process. And then you have the interrupt vector, which I guess is like the trap vector, so let's not go into that. Okay. So the last feature I'll talk about here is synchronization. Okay. Now this requires you to know what the use of synchronization is, which we will not see for a few more classes. Okay. But for now, let's assume that whenever there are multiple processes, occasionally there is a need to coordinate between those processes. Okay. These processes are somehow coordinating with each other to achieve some task. Okay, so, and we'll see what those tasks are later. But at this point, let's assume that you want to coordinate. Okay? The way this coordination works is through a feature called synchronization. You allow processes to synchronize with each other so that they can coordinate or cooperate. Okay? And so there are a variety of mechanisms for synchronization, things called locks, things called semaphores and monitors. We'll come to all of that. Let's not worry about that here. But what we want to know here is what are some low-level hardware features that are used to enable synchronization in the OS. Okay. So the first thing that you want is a guarantee from the architecture, the underlying machine, that if there is a short sequence of important instructions, you want to execute them without actually getting interrupted. And so one way to do that is to actually support the disabling of interrupts. Okay, so if you actually disable interrupts on the machine and then you start executing a process, then the process will continue to execute and nothing can stop it. Okay, because you cannot have timers are interrupts. Okay, you cannot have real interrupts from occurring. Okay, so you can basically disable interrupts on a machine, and that allows that entire sequence of instructions to run without getting interrupted. Okay, that you are executing that piece of code at what is called atomically, okay, without being interrupted by anything. This is one basic feature of synchronization, also called critical section. Okay, we'll come to all of this. Right now, all you need to know is that there are mechanisms to disable and enable interrupts. Okay, so by default, interrupts are enabled, which means whenever an interrupt occurs, you will suspend the execution of that process. You will jump to the interrupt service routine and service that interrupt. Okay. If you don't want the process to be interrupted because it's doing something important, then you will disable interrupts. Okay, so that any interrupt that occurs is actually not going to be delivered, it will be queued for later delivery. Okay, and then when interrupts are enabled, those interrupts will get delivered. Okay, that's one hardware feature for synchronization. The other one, the one that is actually used to enable support by semaphores and locks and other primitives, is what is called a test and set instruction. This is a single instruction that allows you to check the value of a variable and set it both in one single instruction. Typically, if you say something like this, if I equal to 0, set I to 1. Okay. This piece of code checks the value of variable I. Okay. If it is 0, then it will set it to 1. Okay. Typically, executing this block of code will require you to execute a few instructions. Okay. First, you will check the value. Okay. And if it is 0, then you will set it. Okay. What this test and set does is it does that in a single instruction, okay, which means it's atomic. It will basically check the value and set it all in a single instruction, and by doing this can implement all of these higher level primitives. Right now I'm not going to explain how. Okay, when we come to synchronization, we'll go into details of how you can use test and set instruction. Okay, and why do you need to do these two things in one single instruction? What's the problem of actually doing this as separate instructions? Why does it need to execute atomically? All that will become clear in a few lectures. Okay, for now, the only thing you need to know really is the hardware features at the architecture levels to support synchronization are disabling interrupts and the special assembly instructions called test and set. Okay, and those are things that you use to build on for synchronization. Okay, so we have one last slide here on virtual memory. So virtual memory is an abstraction that the OS provides so that it looks like you have infinite RAM on your machine. Okay? Typically a machine is going to have some finite RAM. You might have 2 gig of RAM or 4 gig of RAM or a single gig of RAM. Okay? What the OS does is it takes that RAM and provides the illusion, okay, an abstraction or an illusion that there is no limit. You can have as much processes, as many processes as you want. They can use as much memory as they want. That there is no limit. You are not limited or bound by the actual size of RAM on your machine. Okay. This abstraction is referred to as virtual memory. Okay. The virtual RAM on your machine seems infinite even though the physical RAM on your machine is actually finite. This allows you to run arbitrary number of processes. Okay. There is no limit. I mean, there is really a limit, but it's so large that for practical purposes there is no limit. Okay. And the total size of memory that is required by all the processes that are running on your machine can be far greater than the size of RAM. Okay? In fact, a single process can have a memory footprint that exceeds the size of RAM. If you have 2 gig of memory, you might sometimes see that Firefox or some other process is actually taking 4 gig. Okay? And yet the process continues to run. Okay, so this abstraction is called virtual memory. So just to sort of, if you want to go and do some experiments, you can go to a Linux machine and do top, or on a Mac you can use something like activity monitor. Okay, so then this will tell you the, this is not showing anything. Okay, so you will see that the actual memory and the real memory that's allocated. So here is a process that requires 178 megabyte of memory. It's actually only allocated 6, but it's using 178. This is virtual memory. If you add this column, it will typically exceed the size of RAM. If you add this column, which is real memory, it cannot exceed the size of RAM. So this is the actual amount of RAM allocated. This is the actual amount that the process can possibly request, but it's not given that. Okay. So what this is showing you, and sometimes you will see processes where this number actually exceeds the size of your memory itself. Okay. So what is it that the OS does to do that? That is what we will actually study when we do memory management. Okay, so essentially this removes a physical limit of RAM on your machine. You can start applications or processes without any regard to how much RAM is on the machine. Okay, so in sum, the things to keep in mind is there are several hardware features that make the task of the operating system much simpler. Things like protection and memory management, traps, timers, synchronization features, and so on. Okay. This was a very quick introduction to those hardware features. Okay, now, by no means are you supposed to know everything, but this is just a quick brush introduction. When we go into all of these topics, process management and memory management, we will come back to these features. We will actually see how you can take these features and implement those operating system features. Okay, how do you actually go about implementing it? That is what we will study as we go along. Okay, so we have about 2 minutes. So let's do a quick exercise, okay, just a very quick one. So what I want is take a sheet of paper, okay, and do a minute paper. Okay, a minute paper should take exactly 1 minute and write 2 things. Okay, one is what is it that you liked about this class, and what was one thing that you couldn't understand what I talked about in this class. Okay, so just 2 or 3 sentences. Okay, say something about what is it that you liked about the concepts that we covered, and what is it that you didn't have any clue what I was talking about. Okay, so that will give me some quick feedback on what, whether A, you are listening to what I was saying, and B, if there's something that wasn't clear, I can go back explain that. Okay? And don't take more than 2 minutes. It should be as a very quick exercise, and just for me to keep in mind how things are going.